This is Red Eyes Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and it is good to have you with us. A warm welcome to all our regular listeners, and of course to everyone who's tuning in for the first time. We are coming to you from Gothenburg in Sweden. You can follow us on a regular basis worldwide through our website, redicecreations.com. On our website, you'll find frequently updated news on our some of the things that we consider to be important and interesting. We welcome your tips, feedback, and alerts as well, of course. On our site, you'll also find radio interviews, webcasts, films, and other video material. Check out our members area as well for full access to all of our information and material. We do interviews with researchers, authors, filmmakers on many different subject matters, information that we consider to be important, interesting, urgent, and intriguing. We're not afraid to go into unknown areas and where the information leads us. No topic is off limits as we search for answers, and the conclusions about the information presented on this program will leave up to you. It's the pursuit of truth that counts. We have Twitter feeds with our latest news, YouTube channels, RSS feeds, and also, of course, sign up for our new free newsletter as well, so you can follow us at your convenience and find out what's new on the website. Okay, and today we have Dr. David M. Jacobs with us on the line. He is an associate professor of history at Temple University in Philadelphia, specializing in 20th century American history and culture. He's a former director of the American Studies Program. He's been a UFO researcher for about 45 years. In 1973, he completed his doctoral dissertation in the field of intellectual history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison on the controversy over unidentified flying objects in America. And this was only the second PhD degree granted involving a UFO-related theme. He's written and delivered many articles, papers, and addresses on the subject of UFOs and abductions. He's been a consultant to the major UFO organizations. Since 1977, he has offered the country's only regular curriculum university course on UFOs and abductions called UFOs in American Society. And Dr. Jacobs delivered the first paper to a scientific organization about the abduction phenomena. This was at the Cornell University back in 1989. He participated in the first session on UFOs at the History of Science Society in Washington, D.C. back in 1992. Since the early 80s, he's been specializing in the UFO abduction phenomenon. He has conducted nearly 1,000 hypnotic regressions with over 145 individuals. He has lectured widely on the subject, both internationally and at colleges and universities across the U.S. In 91, Dr. Jacobs, together with Bud Hopkins, conducted the highly publicized Roper Organization poll of the abduction phenomena. This was actually the first scientifically random poll to ascertain the potential number of abductees in the U.S. The results of that influential survey was published in 92, a booklet called The Unusual Personal Experiences. And Dr. Jacobs was an assistant editor for Time Life's best-selling The UFO Phenomenon, published in 89. His second book was called Secret Life, First-Hand Accounts of UFO Abductions. That was published in 92. And his third book, The Threat, was published in 98. He's also written UFOs and Abductions, Challenging the Borders of Knowledge. Dr. Jacobs' first edited volume, published in 2000. And his current projects include books on the methodology of hypnosis for abductees and new developments in the hybrid integration program. And this is something, an area that is really, really interesting that we'll go into in more detail here later in the program. I want to mention his website, of course, ufoabduction.com. Go there for more information about his titles and about the work that Dr. David is doing. But with that, welcome to Red Eyes Radio, and thank you so much for joining us, David.
Well, thank you for having me, Henrik. I appreciate it.
It's really good to have you here, and very long bio, obviously, and as we mentioned here at the introduction, you've been researching UFOs for about 45 years, so you have a lot of information, obviously, that you've gathered during this point, and a lot of interesting things to talk about and go into here today. But one thing that would be interesting to hear right here at the beginning, maybe you can spend a little bit of time on this. Just tell us how you first got involved in this, or how did you get your how did this catch your attention, so to speak, and why did you decide to take this up into a university level and a curriculum and so forth?
Well, I don't really know what got me interested in the subject. I when I was an undergraduate student at the University of California in Los Angeles, I just sort of began to get interested in it for reasons that I don't fully understand. And I read a book about it and I got more into it, interested in it. And it was just, it was more for rest and relaxation, you know, like people might read science fiction or mystery novels or something like that. And the more I read in it, the more I began to understand that this was just not a nonsense subject, that there was more to this than I had imagined. And I continued to do it. And by 1966, I was sort of captured by it in a sense, and I was intrigued by it. And I remember once that I saw in the newspaper that a UFO convention was coming to Los Angeles, where I lived, and I was thrilled that something like that was going to go on. And so I took my wife and a couple of friends, and we all went down to this UFO convention. And there was sort of a mixed bag of people, shall we say. It was the good, the bad, the ugly. And we sat in the balcony and we heard a bunch of speeches and lectures and so forth. But then the main event came, and the main event was a full color motion picture taken by someone of a UFO hovering relatively closely by, relatively close to the camera. And it was big, it was glorious, it was beautiful, it was spinning, it was silver, it was absolutely amazing. And if you squinted your eyes, if you closed your eyelids enough, you could avoid seeing the string it was hanging from. And that was extremely embarrassing. Because I brought friends with us. And at that point, I should have just said, to hell with all this. This is ridiculous. I've been duped and I've been fooled and gone about my business and had a normal life. But in fact, I said, well, okay, so it was a fake. So we'll just move. I'll move ahead. And I continued to do reading and research in it. By the time I went to graduate school in August of 1966, I determined that I was going to read every single word ever written about the subject of UFOs. Now, in 1966, that was possible. That was something when you could actually do it. It wasn't an unattainable goal. It was something that could be done. It can't be done now. Now it is impossible. But in those days, it was possible.
Just so, too much out there these days, right?
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's thousands and thousands of books, and it's overwhelming. So, but in those days, I started doing it, and so I started reading everything I could. And in the meantime, I was doing my own graduate work in history, and I wrote a master's thesis on the reception of Freudian ideas into the American psychological and psychiatric community between 1909 and 1929. And then I started working on my doctoral dissertation, which was on the image of women in very early motion picture history, pre-1915. And I did about 6 months worth of research in that, and all the while, I'm going home and reading stuff about flying saucers. And finally, I couldn't stand it anymore. So I went to the chairman of my PhD committee and told him I wanted to change my dissertation topic and go with the controversy over unidentified flying objects. Yeah. And no scholarly work had been written about that. And he thought that was a great idea. He thought that was a terrific idea. And I changed my dissertation topic, and he immediately left to get a job at another university.
So it was just like that? No problem?
With him, because he was leaving. Then right. Suddenly I did not have a person to work with anymore, and I had to get somebody else. And I knew that this was a very fringe subject, even in the 1960s, when it was, oddly, when it was more accepted than it is now. And I finally wound up going with another professor, a man named Paul Konkin. And Konkin was extremely dubious about this dissertation topic, but he finally agreed to it, and I became one of his students, and he was extremely a very good editor and very good to me, and I wound up writing this dissertation, which was later published with Indiana University Press as the UFO Controversy in America. And ever since then, I got my PhD in 1973, and ever since then, I've been doing nothing but, well, mainly I've been doing UFO and abduction research. So I just got into it. I can't tell you why. It just happened. It was my fate. It was my destiny. It was my karma. It was my craziness. It was all those things put together.
And what would you say if you, like, paint a general picture for us here, for those who might wonder what your research has yielded, so to speak. Is there any easy way to kind of capsulize it for us before we kind of go into detail into some of these cases and where things seem to be leading right now?
Well, I think we should probably talk about, if you want to talk about abductions, which I've concentrated on exclusively since the early 1980s.
Yes.
There are very few abduction researchers in the world. There are some, of course, but here in the United States, there's only a few that sort of know what they're doing. And the problem with researching abductions is it's a lot more difficult than researching UFOs. With UFOs, by the mid 1970s. We knew everything that could be known about the UFO phenomenon. In other words, we had thousands and thousands and thousands of sightings that were investigated. We knew what they looked like, how long they lasted in terms of being seen, you know, how long they were in the vicinity. We knew what kind of movements they had. And if the objects were sighted at night and they had lights on them, we knew what kind of lighting they had. There were all sorts of, we knew everything about the credibility of witnesses. It was every conceivable kind of witness from the President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, on down to people who are not the President. And everybody in between, and professors, and a rabbi, a minister, and a priest, and on. We knew everything you could know about. Objects were seen on the grounds. We had tests about how heavy the object was. We knew about their effects on the environment. We knew about their effects on people. We knew about their effects on mechanical devices, on electrical devices, on and on and on and on by the 1970s, by the mid-70s. In 1969, UFO researcher Alan Hynek called it. I'm sorry, 1971. He called it the embarrassment of riches. We had an overwhelming amount of evidence, films, radar, audio tapes, every conceivable kind of evidence you could have except a UFO. So since that time, since the mid 1970s. All UFO investigations have served one purpose and one purpose only, and that is that they validate the fact, they verify the fact that a strange, unusual object, artificially constructed, under intelligent control, and anomalous, that is to say, not from any area that we could possibly think of here on Earth, flew within sight of credible witnesses. And even might have made marks on the ground or whatever it is. So, you know, we have every sighting since then has not added to our knowledge of the phenomenon. It has only verified and validated what we already know. The problem then is that you've come across a sort of limit of knowledge about UFOs, because UFOs are simply the outside shells of objects. It's the inside that's the important thing, obviously.
Yes.
If there, and for many years, many UFO researchers refused to look inside. They wouldn't. That was a line over which they would not step. They wouldn't step over that line. You know, looking at the outside shells of objects. Okay, that's one thing. And you know, some UFO researchers are extremely conservative. And even though the evidence is overwhelming that this is not a terrestrial phenomenon, they'll say, well, it's unidentified, and the unidentified means that we're still searching for the identity. Well, you know, we may never find it, but so everybody sort of has a comfort zone that they live in.
Yeah.
But somewhere along the way, starting in the 1960s especially, people began to report what UFO researchers called occupants. And because you couldn't say aliens, that would be crazy. And eventually they became known as humanoids because they looked slightly human. So, but the aliens was a word you never uttered in the United States. And there were oddities taking place as well. We got a couple in 1957. We had an abduction event happen in Brazil that was reported to us that had a sort of sexual or reproductive content to it. That was so embarrassing and so totally crazy, to use that word again, that it was not even published until 1966, until 9 years later. Then we had the Barney and Betty Hill case in 1961, which was also published in 1966. And the problem here was these cases were interesting. They were, but they didn't make a pattern. And the question is, with UFOs, everything's a matter of patterns. If you have one object doing one thing, it doesn't mean anything. If you have 1,000 objects doing one thing, it means something. Then you have a pattern.
Yeah.
And UFOs fit very neatly into patterns. And patterns were all identified early on. But abductions were a whole different situation, because they came out of people's minds without that whole range of evidence that UFOs had accompanying them. Photographs and radar tracings and 8mm and 16mm and 32mm film and tapes and everything else. That did not exist with abductions. Not only that, but the abduction scared UFO researchers. It scared them because in the 1950s in the United States, there were a group of people known as contactees. These were characters who tried to make a buck, tried to make a dollar off of the flying saucer phenomenon. And they claimed to have met beautiful, wonderful, benevolent space brothers who gave them rides in flying saucers and would take them here and there wherever they wanted to go, and sometimes would take them up to the moon and sometimes to Venus and sometimes to Uranus and sometimes to Jupiter or wherever they wanted to go. And one guy claimed that he had dinner with the king of the moon, and the air on the moon was just like the air that you and I breathe here and all that. Mm-hmm. And the legitimate UFO research organizations spent 10 years battling the contactees and trying to show that they did not represent UFO witnesses or the UFO phenomenon, that they were fake, they were charlatans, etc. When the abductees came along, most UFO researchers had three words to say. No, no, no. That was it. They'd already been there. They'd been there. They'd done that. Now you got other people claiming they've been inside flying saucers and met aliens. No, 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 no. And so the vast majority of UFO researchers in the 1960s and 70s and into the 80s absolutely refused to accept the idea that the abduction phenomenon had a life of its own, was a legitimate phenomenon, and that people, in fact, were being abducted. I was one of those people. I knew about Barney Betty Hill, and I read a little bit about the Antonio Villas-Boas case and all that. But they did not make a pattern. This could still be psychological in origin. And so I was a conservative UFO researcher, and I was not going to go to where the abductees were. This was the stance that I took until 1982. And in that year, in 1981, I was speaking at a conference in Chicago at Northwestern University, well, put on by the Center for UFO Studies and Alan Hynek. Alan Hynek was the sponsor of this conference, and he, of course, was the chief UFO researcher in at that period.
Yeah.
And a fellow by the name of Bud Hawkins was there giving a paper about abductions, the abduction phenomenon. Now, I had never heard a paper about abductions before, and I knew that the abduction phenomenon was just nonsense. It was not worth my time. So when Hawkins got up to give his paper, I got up and wandered into the hallway and told jokes with a friend of mine named Marcello Truzzi, who was a professor of sociology at Eastern Michigan University. For the whole hour that Bud talked, rather than waste my time listening to nonsense about abductions, it was more interesting to me to listen to Marcello's jokes. He was a specialist in jokes. He had thousands of them. To hear him than to hear Bud Hawkins. So that shows you sort of where I was psychologically in 1981.
Yeah.
In 1982, a mutual friend, a man named Tracy Torme, who is now a writer, producer in Hollywood, and the son of a famous singer named Mel Torme, called me up and said that he had something very important to tell me about. He was a conspiracy theorist, and he found where the conspiracy to hide the government study of UFOs was centered, and he couldn't tell me over the phone and all that. And so I met him in Central Park in New York, and he told me where he thought it was. It turns out not to be the truth, of course. I mean, it wasn't factually correct. But he said, okay, David, now I'm going down to my friend Bud Hopkins' house. Why don't you come on with me? I said, I don't think so, Tracy. I don't think I want to do that. He said, no, he's a nice guy. Come on. No, Tracy, no. Come on, get in the cab, come on. Okay. So we go down to 16th Street, where Bud lives. And, of course, Tracy didn't quite know where the address is. We had to go from house to house looking, see if it was his name was on the doorbell there. And we found it. And here comes Bud Hopkins, who I'd actually shaken hands with the year before, and I didn't even remember that. And the first thing I noticed about Hopkins was he was very, very intelligent. The second thing was this guy was an excellent, excellent artist. And as if anybody knows anything about Bud Hopkins, he has been an artist all his life. He has done nothing but art for his entire adult life. And he was a member of the New York School, which is a very famous art community in New York City in the 1950s and 60s. And his friends were Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko and all the major figures of the New York School he was involved with. And he began to tell me sort of what he was doing with his abduction work. It was actually interesting. Now, we stayed for an hour or so, maybe 2 hours. Then it was time to leave. So we walk out onto the sidewalk, his house joins right onto the sidewalk in New York City, and walk out on the sidewalk, and he says, by the way, he says, what are you doing this summer? And I said, well, we've just had a baby, and we used to go to Maine, which is quite a ways from Philadelphia for vacation, but this time we're not going to do that because of the baby, so we're going to a small town in Cape Cod, which juts out of Massachusetts. And the town is called Wellfleet, and that's where we're going to spend a couple of weeks on vacation. He said, Wellfleet. He said, I own a house in Wellfleet. I spend every summer in Wellfleet. Now, this is a town that is not well known. Mm-hmm. It was just one of these sort of amazing coincidences. So when we got there in the summer, it turned out that I was staying right close to him, but that's not hard to do in Wellfleet because everything is pretty close together. And he invited me up to his place, and he showed me what he was doing, and he introduced me to some abductees. Of course, I'd never met an abductee before, it was actually sort of remarkable what he was finding. I came back to Philadelphia, and I called up Alan Hynek, and I talked with Alan and his wife, Mimi, and I said, I just came back from Wellfleet, and I talked with this guy, Bud Hopkins, up there, and, Alan, I said, I think he's on to something. I think he's found something here. His stuff was not as crazy as I thought it was going to be. I think he's really, this is an area we should look into. And Alan said, no, don't do that, David. You just stick with UFOs. Don't go into that abduction stuff, I said, I don't know, Alan. He was pretty impressive, and his work was impressive, too, and, I think this is something we should look more into. He said, no, don't do it. Don't do it. Luckily, or I did not take his advice. Actually, I probably should have taken his advice, but I didn't. And I continued to communicate with Bud, and he invited me up to his house after the summer was over with. And I had attended abduction meetings that he had with abductees, and I sat in on sessions that he did with people. And this is 82. By 1986, I had decided to do hypnosis and to find out what this was all about myself. And so since 1986, I have been doing nothing but hypnosis with abductees. That's essentially what I do these days. And so that's sort of the story of how I ever got into this anyway.
Yeah.
Bud Hopkins is my closest friend in the world, and we talk all the time and all that. So that's what I do. So then the question is, well, what is a typical abduction event?
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote about this in Secret Life, and in my second book called Secret Life, which was just sort of a typical abduction event that everybody goes through. And basically, a person is taken out of their normal environment, and they're taken on board a UFO, an alien craft, shall we say. They're clothes are removed, they're put on a table, they have a series of reproductive, physical, and mental procedures run on them, administered to them. There's a series of other events that happen to them. They might have to hold a bizarre-looking baby, something that Bud discovered in the early 1980s, a baby that looks sort of half-human, half-alien. They might have to do other procedures that are involved with that we know about. They're then taken back into the room where their clothes were taken off. Their clothes are put back on. They're taken back to their normal environment, which might be their car, their backyard, their bed, their couch, wherever it is. And within seconds, not minutes, but seconds, they have forgotten what has happened to them. They know something odd happened. For example, if they're driving somewhere, they know that they've been driving at 60 miles an hour or whatever it is, for 4 hours. And now it's, and they've been on the road for 2 hours, and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, let's just say it's for everybody to understand it. It's 10 a.m. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. And now it's suddenly 12 o'clock. And yet they're still driving. They're on the road, but they're in the same spot more or less, which of course is not possible. That is just not possible.
Yeah.
Now, you might think to yourself, I've had a stroke. I pulled out to the side of the road. I had a stroke, and now I'm sort of coming out of it. There's been a brain, a vessel in my brain that exploded. Who knows what happened? And now I've gotten back, and I'm driving again. And that's why I've had this missing time period. But this is extremely common with abductees, And it is not so common with people who've had strokes. You're going to have after effects of that. You're going to know something awful has happened in your head.
Yeah.
But they know something went on if there is a time element involved with it. That, you know, they should be 2 hours, they should be, you know, 150 miles down the road and they shouldn't be where they are and that sort of thing. That alerts them that something happened.
Yeah.
For most people, let's just say if it's done at night, when they're asleep, they get back in the bed and they wake up in the morning, they're tired. There's no doubt about it. They're tired. Even though they thought they slept all night long, but it was completely seamless. They don't remember anything at all. So therefore the question is, well, how do they remember? And the answer is that perhaps 95 to 99% don't remember ever. But a small percentage of people remember, have bleed through memories. They remember lying on a table. They remember, somebody in their room. They'll have little bits and pieces of memory that bleed through.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who sort of come to me or to Bud Hopkins or to other serious abduction researchers to find out what the heck has happened to them and why can't they remember and all that.
Yeah.
I'll let you get a word in edgewise, Henrik.
Absolutely. I mean, this is really interesting to hear this, the general outline, some of the history and background, so to speak, on the phenomenon and how your work kind of have progressed, so to speak. But how, in regards to hypnosis and so forth, was this something that Bud Hopkins himself then first got into and then you latched on, so to speak, to this idea as well and said that, yeah, this is a reasonable way to try to figure out what has happened to these people who have this missing time?
Right. Well, hypnosis, of course, was a known tool already, even when Bud started to do it. And that was because the very first American case that we heard of, it's not the first American case that ever took place, but the first case that we heard of was the Barney and Betty Hill case, which remains the most famous abduction case of all time. And that was an interracial couple who were in the state of New Hampshire, who were abducted from their car and taken on board a UFO and given examinations, and they said, and then released, and they forgot what happened to them within seconds. Their memories were recovered through the use of hypnosis by a very famous hypnotist who was a major hypnotist for the U.S. Army in World War II and done lots of important work, and he was located in Boston. And so we knew that hypnosis could unlock memories. James Harder, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, had done hypnosis with abductees. And Leo Sprinkle, a professor of psychology at the University of Wyoming, had done hypnosis with abductees. And other people had as well. The problem was that the stories were all over the place. And it was difficult to get a complete analysis of what had happened to somebody. When Bud started to do hypnosis, he didn't do it himself. He went to a psychologist who did the hypnosis for several years for him. And the problem with the psychologist was she didn't know anything about the abduction phenomenon. And nobody did, really. So it was difficult to understand what was to be believed and what was not to be believed when people said that they were being abducted. Bud began to do his own work, as he said, and he understood sort of what the techniques were by paying very close attention to what she was doing. And he was much, much better at hypnosis, much, much better. He is extremely empathetic with abductees and sympathetic and extremely kind and good. And he understood that a lot of people had gone through a lot of trauma. And so he dedicated himself to not only understanding what was happening with abductions, but trying to heal the people who were traumatized by it.
Yeah.
And that's what I sort of did too. I sat in on his hypnosis sessions, and then I decided I would learn how to do hypnosis myself. I wrote down every word he said, and I didn't sit on that many of them, but there was a bunch. And I read books about hypnosis and all that. And then I never took a course in it. I'm not a certified hypnotherapist. But I learned after a while it doesn't matter. What matters is abduction hypnosis is very different than regular hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
But in regular hypnosis, the staples of regular hypnosis in the U.S. and probably throughout the world is try to get people to stop smoking, try to get people to eat less, try to get people to relieve stress.
Right.
That's commercial hypnosis. In medicine, you do hypnosis to try to relieve pain sometimes. And in forensic hypnosis, you try to get people to do age regression to get them to post-traumatic stress disorder by reliving horrendous traumatic events in their lives, and also to try to remember license plates. If a crime is committed, the car sped away, maybe you can remember the license plate, things
yes.
like that.
And this is what should we call it? A successful science as well. The information, so to speak, is able to be extracted from through the aid of hypnosis. Is that right?
It's a mixed bag. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. There's enough yes to have people continue to keep doing it. But you have to be aware that hypnosis is not the royal road to the truth.
Right.
And people are mistaken under hypnosis all the time. All the people who do hypnosis, all these psychologists and forensic people and attorneys and police officers and certified hypnotherapists, that means nothing
yeah.
when it comes to the abduction world. It's a totally different kind of questioning pattern that you have to ask. And anybody can do it. And here in the United States, you do not have to be you don't have to be certified. You don't have to be licensed. You don't have to do anything to be a hypnotist, because hypnosis is just words. You're just telling somebody words in private. You know what I mean? There can't be a law against it, in a sense. So, but in fact, the problem with most hypnotists when it comes to the abduction work is that no matter how intensely educated they are in regular hypnosis, they don't know what questions to ask in hypnosis, in abduction hypnosis, and they don't know how to interpret what they hear, and they can't recognize false memories when they hear them. That's the major, major, major problem.
Mm.
And so when I started doing hypnosis to try to figure out what was happening, Bud referred a woman to me. And I was nervous beyond imagination. I had never done hypnosis in my life, of course. This woman showed up on my doorstep. She told me she was coming in. And we had agreed we were going to look at a certain incident. I was so nervous that I wrote out an induction on a little 3x5 card that I put on the palm of my hand. And I sat sort of behind her head so that she couldn't see that I was looking at this card, because I didn't want her to think that I was a total idiot like I was and a rank amateur. But she had a lot of experience in channeling. That is to say, channeling is a dissociative state, in my opinion, where one part of the mind gets in touch with another part of the mind, to put it simply, and communicates, and the communication is interpreted as coming from the outside,
interesting.
Like from dead people or from space aliens or from spirits who live in the ether or whatever.
Yeah.
So we had agreed that we would look at an event that happened when she was 7 years old, when she goes into this kind of trance that, which is really a misnomer. You're not in a trance in hypnosis. In fact, most people, when I do hypnosis, don't even think they're hypnotized. They'll sit up and they say, "I don't think I'm hypnotized. You know, I'm feeling just normal." And the answer is, it doesn't matter. Lay back down. And it doesn't.
what happens when you tap into
well here's what happened in this first story. When I've told this story many times, but it's very, very illustrative of the problems.
Right.
So here I am. I'm about to do hypnosis with an abductee, or supposedly. I don't know. She doesn't know. Nobody knows. All she remembers when she was 7 years old, she was on a grassy area in a park with a friend of hers, and she was looking at a butterfly or a buttercup, which is a flower or something like that. And she bent over, and then she was sort of in that bent over position, and she felt somebody sort of putting their arms around her waist, and she was taken up into a UFO, and she saw that was what she remembered. So we figured I'd look at that. It wasn't a dream or anything. It was in the middle of the day. She was with somebody. So there she is. I bring her back to this park, and there were kids playing a game of American baseball and all that. Not too close to her, but down somewhat from where she was, up on a slope. And she bends over, and she looks down at the ground, and then she feels this arms around her, and she's lifted up, and she goes into this UFO, into this craft. And there she's with a guy who's got sort of a long hair, page boy haircut, which I'd never heard of anything like that before. And she has a name for him. She's familiar to her. This guy's familiar to her. And he puts her on a table and takes off her clothes and does this to her and that to her and this to her. And there's a gynecological procedure that is performed on her. And she's extremely embarrassed to talk about this, but she does. Then she gets off the table and he walks the escort, this guy with her, walks with her down a hallway, a corridor, and she sees a small gray alien walking towards her. Mm. The alien stops, and now she is supposed to put her hands on the alien's head. And she does that, and when she does that, she feels love and warmth and affection emanating from him. And then she takes her hand off of his head, and the feeling stops. She continues walking down the hallway with her escort and the guy with this taller guy with a page boy haircut and goes into another room. And there's a group of aliens sitting around sort of like a table or a desk or something. And she sits on a bench on the wall and they sit around. They talk about how when she grows up, she's going to grow up to be beautiful and intelligent and she's going to have a wonderful life, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what's in her future, see? And then that's it. They take her away, take her back into the room where she was originally, put her clothes back on, take her back to the field, and the deed is done. And so she left eventually, and I was thrilled to death, and I called up Bud Hopkins, and we compared notes, and it was wonderful. It was amazing. It was fantastic. And I had recorded the whole thing on this little tape recorder I had. And that night, I went up to transcribe whatever she had said onto my computer so that I could read it, you know. Mm-hmm. And in my naivete, in my innocence, I thought that my little tape recorder with its tiny little condenser mic would pick up every word she whispered. And there was nothing on that tape at all, except for occasional grunts, and there was with me talking every once. So it was horrible. I literally broke into a cold sweat, thinking, "Oh my God, I've lost it! I've lost it! This treasure, this amazing thing." But she came back. What I thought I'd do is I just remember what she said. So I began to type what she remembered, and I learned very quickly. You can't do that. That's not going to happen. You're not going to remember what anybody said if they spoke for an hour. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
So she came back for another session, and then she came back for another session. We had a bunch of sessions. After maybe a month or so, a couple of months, I said, Melissa, remember that session that we did, the very first one? She said, yeah, yeah. I said, well, I had a little trouble with the tape recorder, and I felt like an idiot saying this to her. Could we do this? Could we do that one over again? And she said, well, sure. No problem. Okay. Mm. So there she is on the grassy area and she's bent over and then somebody picks her up and takes her on board. And it's this guy with his page boy haircut, and she's got a name for him and all the rest of that stuff, and puts her on a table, and then he does this to her and that to her and this to her and that to her, and there's a gynecological procedure she's very, very embarrassed to talk about. And then she gets off the table and puts her clothes back on and comes back down. And I said, Melissa, remember the first time we talked about how you walked in a hallway and put your hands on this gray alien's head, and you felt love and all that coming from him? And she said, you know, I don't think that happened to me. And then I said, well, what about when they took you into this room and there was this council set up, and you grew up to be beautiful and strong and intelligent and all that stuff when you were an adult and all? She says, I don't think that happened to me. I think that happened to a friend of mine. That didn't happen to me. And I knew at that instant that I did not know what I was doing with hypnosis. I did not know. I had no controls in place. I could not separate fantasy from reality. I couldn't tell when people were telling me things that weren't true. I did not know.
Yeah.
At that point, I began to institute a set of controls that I worked out, that Bud Hopkins worked out, that others have worked out since then. And the controls, I vowed at that point that was never going to happen to me again if I could help it. And the problem is that most people who do hypnosis never have that lesson. They tend to believe everything that everybody says at face value. Whatever they say is the truth. That leads them into religious interpretations, into transformational interpretations, into spiritual interpretations, into every conceivable kind of interpretation about what's going on that you can imagine. And people are all over the map. And it all has to do in large part with their own personal agendas, with the hypnotist's personal sense of what's going to be important and what's not going to be important and what they're looking for. So hypnosis is a tricky business, and there's a learning curve involved with it, and you cannot accept what people say at face value, and you have to learn how to interpret what they're saying, and learn how to, if you hear something that you've never heard before, to just put it aside and wait for other people to say the same thing, because you're looking for patterns. Other people say the same thing who are unaware of that testimony. And you learn how to ask purposely misleading questions to see whether they'll answer those misleading questions that you know the answer to, and the answer has nothing to do with UFOs that we know about or abductions. And if they say yes, you have to be extremely, extremely, extremely careful, because those people can be led. And and there's all sorts of other things that you do to institute controls so that you know that what you're getting is going to be as solid as you could possibly get it. And even then, you have to be extremely careful. So,
well, that is interesting, because then in this particular case, she seemed to edit out the only information in regards to the alien portion here, so to speak. How did you interpret that? That something else actually had happened to her? Or how did you go about dealing with that?
Well, yeah, I did a whole series of sessions with her over a year's time. And you begin to see the patterns coming in, patterns that Bud had found already within his group. And the same things were happening. There were reproductive procedures. There was medical procedures, et cetera, et cetera. And different events that had happened to her. However, there's something going on in the background here with my own brain. And what I was looking at, and what Bud was looking at, and what all researchers were looking at, was a model that we had constructed in our minds based on previous abduction events that we knew about, from Barney and Betty Hill, or Antonio Villas-Boas in Brazil, or the Hickson and Parker in Pascagoula, Mississippi in 1973, or Travis Walton. And all the other American cases, we had a body of knowledge that had shaped our sense of what this was all about. And it was basically, it had two aspects. It was, number one, an experimental model. They were experimenting on us. They were learning about us. it was a study situation, and that's what was happening. The other part of this was it was an adult onset single event. A person is in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they are abducted. The first thing that we learned was that was not true. People who are abductees are abducted from the time they're infants into old age. We did not know the frequency. We thought maybe once every couple of years, you know, once a decade, whatever. But in fact, the frequency is extremely high. So an abductee lives with abductions all through their lives. And it happens, it can happen almost on a nightly basis in special situations and circumstances. It can happen once a week. It can happen once a month. But it happens a lot over the course of a lifetime. And it happens more with women, I think, than with men. But it happens to men and women equally. But I held on. We all held on to the experimental model, the model of the learning situation, all the way through the 1990s. And I finally realized it's not an experiment. They're not studying us. The evidence just does not hold. There is no evidence that they're studying us. It was a dead end. It was a false assumption. And it never was an experiment. It might have been when it first started many, many, many years ago, but not now. And so what I discovered was that this was not an experiment. They weren't studying us. They weren't learning about us. This was a program. And it was almost assembly line fashion. Everybody involved with the program had all the people who were conducting it had certain procedures that they performed. They had jobs to do. They were sort of, it was very routinized. It was very, very efficient. Abductees had a certain set of procedures that were going to be run on them for various reasons. And, as a program, it had a beginning, it had a middle, and it almost certainly had an end because programs, generally speaking, are goal directed. In other words, there's a reason why they're doing this. So that's sort of what I discovered as I began to do this kind of research. Wow. But even then, it's very hard to do. No, I'm in the process of writing, although I put it aside for the past year, a 200 or maybe 300 page book, manuscript on methodology and how to do hypnosis with abductees. Aimed at the therapeutic and scientific community, if at all, if they're interested, which they're not. So if anybody wants to do hypnosis, at least they can do it correctly according to my techniques, and get sort of the best and most solid information that they possibly can, because there's no standardization of procedures. There's no standardization of methodology for doing hypnosis.
Right.
And I need to standardize the field as much as I can. So that's what I've been working on, plus other things as well.
That's interesting. So it's for the point of view that you made it more scientific, so to speak, in that sense, and it should be something that other people should be able to replicate as well, then, in regards to how to basically extract information from the abductees. Is that right?
That is exactly my goal, replication, and if they do everything correctly, and if they don't take everything at face value, and if they're very careful and very cautious, they will, in my opinion, get the same accounts that both Bud Hopkins and I have gotten for years, although I've gone much more into depth in the phenomenon than most anybody, and I'm looking for other people to verify what I've been finding as well.
Yeah.
But there are so few people who do this research that, you see, the problem here, Henrik, is this. When people come forward and say that they want to know what's happened to them, they don't know, they might have been the psychologist, they might have been to New Age groups, they might have been to to their clergy, priests or ministers to find out what's going on with them, and nothing has satisfied them. When they come to me, they want to know what's going on with them. They also know that if they have been involved with the abduction phenomenon, to talk about it is all downside and no upside. It's all negative. Mm-hmm. Nothing in their lives will be enhanced by claiming to people that they're being abducted by people from another planet or wherever.
Yeah.
This is not a good thing. This is a bad thing in every level. They don't want to use their names. They don't want to be on television for the most part, although some are. They don't want to talk about it to their families, to their workers, co-workers. It's all downside.
David, what we actually can do is we can take a little break right here between the segments. What we can do is, I mean, obviously I have so much more to ask you, and I want to ask you about the program that is being run, about some of the experiences that the people seem to be having, and if some of these cases can be interpreted from how they would be interpreted from a psychological point of view, or if some flat out believe something has happened to them, but it actually hasn't, and so forth. But as a way of just rounding up here for the first hour, and then we'll continue talking more here for our members, but give out your websites again and mention the titles to your books so people who want to dive further into the research that you've done can do so.
Okay, my website is www.ufoabduction.com. Just abduction, not abductions. That's a whole different world with an S on the end. So ufoabduction.com. And I still have three books in print, Secret Life, The Threat, and UFOs and Abductions Challenging the Borders of Knowledge. That's an edited book where 10 authors have written articles specific for that particular book about the UFO phenomenon and the abduction phenomenon in general. And they're all available through Amazon.com, basically.
Brilliant.
Or other bookstores.
So again, the website, ufoabduction.com. We will have this linked up on redascreations.com as well, so you can go there, take a look at the work that David does, and we'll continue here talking more in the next segment. All right. Thank you for joining us here for the first hour with David M. Jacobs. We are going to continue our discussion for about another 2 hours in our member section, and we are just getting started. David unveils his research into the abduction and hybrid program next up. We'll discuss a few abduction accounts and different perspectives, different possibilities about the situation that seems to be unfolding according to the research that David and Bud Hopkins have been doing. The abduction and hybrid program is pretty much changing and moving towards integration between humans and hybrids. They are literally moving into society. We talk about the alien hierarchy, different races, and pretty much what the outcome would be of or consequences of full integration, and also how quickly this is taking place. This is very disturbing, the picture that David paints for us, but again, very, if true, very, very important to know about. So, to continue listening to our conversation, hour 2 and hour 3, head on over to our website, redicecreations.com, R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. If you're not yet a member, click on subscribe, sign up, and get instant access to our member section. It's fast, safe, and easy. You'll get full access to our archives, of course, with radio, webcasts, films, and video interviews. All right, folks, we'll take a short break right here, listen to some music, as we'll get ready for much more.